So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you all very much for coming. I hope you think you're in a seminar about creating capacity for change on legal and governance issues. If you don't want to be here, feel free to go now. This is your chance to get out. So, good, thank you. Good to see so many of you here. As you would have gathered from this morning's introduction, if you were in the meeting, my name's Caroline Ead. I have only just joined FIC Practical Services. I'm a charity lawyer by specialist, and I'm here to try and help churches and Christian organisations with legal and governance issues. We have the whole team, I think, well, most of the team here from Practical Services with us today. They are here so that you can meet them, but also so that they can answer all the difficult questions at the end. So thank you all very much for coming. You'll see they've got blue hoodies. I've taken mine off because I was too hot, but the blue hoodies with legal questions here to help. If you've got questions over the course of these couple of days, feel free to come and ask us about those things. Let's just pray as we start, and then I'll tell you what we're about to do. Heavenly Father, thank you so much for each church that is represented here. Thank you for each one that you have called to serve you in various ways in those church contexts. And I pray that as we think about these legal issues this afternoon, you would be equipping us to serve you well in those situations and blessing us by your Spirit as we think about the particular challenges that we each face. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, so I just realised we've got competition. I will shout louder. you should each have on your chairs a handout. There are various things on your chairs. Some of them are bits of information from Practical Services, but you should also have an A4 handout. Everybody got one of those? We've got spares if you feel like any of those will be useful for your fellow workers back at home, then feel free to take some. We will have questions, but I think at the end there's a risk otherwise that we will just get waylaid on whatever questions you may be throwing at me. So we'll plow on through. There'll be various points at which we'll break because I've got some questions for you to think about as well. So it won't be an hour and a quarter of me talking solidly. Okay, so the aim of the session today is to help you think about the structural and legal questions that will make growth and change easier in your church. As I said, we're thinking about the trellis that supports the vine. In other words, the things that make it easier for you to have good structures in place so that the work of evangelism and discipleship can continue unhindered, and so that you don't end up being distracted from that work by other things that get in the way. Obviously, the assumption behind that is that you have growth and change as a strategic aim in your churches. That's everything we've been talking about, isn't it, for these past few days, and everything that Fabiti's been talking about, that you're aiming at growth in your churches. And by growth, I mean the kind of transformation that the gospel brings in people's lives. So as people come to know about Christ, come to repentance and faith in him, as they come to walk with him more closely and increasing maturity in their own faith. So when I say growth or change, that may or may not mean a growth in numbers. It may or may not mean a church plant. It may or may not mean additional buildings. Do you see what I mean? I just don't want people to mishear me when I talk about the word growth, okay? But it may mean any of those things. And in particular, in terms of getting the gospel out to people, we are hoping and praying, aren't we, that actually churches will grow and they will increase in number in that sense as well. In terms of the biblical context for what we're doing this afternoon, I think there are two streams of biblical thought. One is all of those kind of indications and references we get in places like Acts 6, where the apostles are at risk of being of their time being squeezed and of the work of teaching and ministering being pressured out. And they appoint the seven to do the kind of good works that Fabiti was talking about this morning. So they put in place a delegation structure. They put in place some kind of system for making sure the work of the church happens well. Okay, that's one stream. Another example in Exodus 18, where Jethro says to Moses, all these people are coming to you with all their problems. You can't manage. You need to delegate. So it's, you know, I think there's a good biblical precedent for thinking, how do we get things done well? And how do we create structures that do things well so that our effectiveness is increased? That's one biblical stream. And then the other, again, we also heard about this morning in Titus 3, is the biblical mandate to be submissive to the authorities and to be operating in a way that is legally compliant insofar as we're able to do so under God. So that's the kind of biblical framework of where we're heading this afternoon. A number of caveats. Firstly, I'm going to assume nothing, okay? My starting point is to assume that you don't necessarily, you aren't necessarily familiar with these issues and you don't know about them already. I'm really sorry if that means for some of you, some of this is, you know, going over old ground. My experience has been that for some people, the things that I think or that they may think are the most obvious are actually the most helpful to somebody else. So bear with us. If you've got something that you think, I know this, there'll be somebody else in the room who's thinking, oh, my goodness, I didn't know that at all. So do bear with us. And the other thing is, some of what I'm going to say will sound a little bit trivial. And there'll be examples. I'll highlight them as you go through. But I think, to my mind, creating the capacity for change is really about, in one sense, it's a big strategic issue, but in another sense, it's about making sure that the basics are in place so that they don't trip you up later, okay? So there are particular examples where, unless you've got something that seems quite trivial right, it will just cause massive unnecessary hassle, and you will find yourself distracted from the work of the gospel by having to reply to Charity Commission letters, basically. And that's the last thing we want you to be spending your time doing as church leaders. So the focus today is on all stuff that happens kind of behind the scenes in churches, as it were. And if they're handled well, I think they probably just won't be visible to church members most of the time. So the areas we're going to cover, you'll see on your handouts, are the implications of charitable status, what that means for you to be a charity, trusteeship and some questions around who trustees should be, governance more generally, what good governance looks like in a church, staff and volunteers, buildings and premises, constitution issues, and risk management and insurance. Now, if we get through all of that, we'll be doing really well. So there may be points at which I think we'll skip over it, we've got handouts on it, or you can come and ask us questions about it. But let's just see how we go. And we're aiming to be done, I think, in about an hour and a quarter. So let's just begin with charitable status and the implications of what it means for churches to be charities. So by definition, I'm pretty sure almost uncategorically every church is a charity. I find it really hard to think of an example of a church that wouldn't be a charity. Whether or not it is required to register as a charity, it is a charity as a matter of law and is therefore subject to charity law and ultimately subject to the Charity Commission oversight in how that law is applied, whether or not you are registered. Okay. First question for you guys. What is a charity? Anybody got any thoughts about how you define, and not practical services people, please. anybody else? Any thoughts about how a charity is defined legally? Doesn't matter if you get it wrong. Sorry? Not act for profit. Key, yes. I'll come back to that, but that is a crucial part of it. Yeah. Benefit, yes. And actually, those are part of the same test. So the test, that bit of the test you're both talking about, is called the public benefit test. So it's got to operate in a way that isn't just for the private benefit of shareholders, but is for the public benefit more widely. That's one. That's a crucial part of the test. There are two others, one of which isn't very helpful. Specific aim or aims. What kind of aim or aims? Sorry, I'm pushing you slightly. Anybody else? Yeah, kind of social. So there, to be honest, there's a whole list of charitable purposes, and the list is set out in statute in the 2011 Act. There are basically 13, with a bit of fudging around the edges, of recognised charitable purposes. Okay, so a charity is an organisation that exists for charitable purposes, and those are recognised in law, and that operates for the public benefit. The third bit is that you have to be in England and Wales. We don't worry about that. We're in England and Wales. So charitable purposes and public benefit are the two key elements of what it means to be a charity. You just are a charity if you are doing those two things. So if you set up even a really loose, informal grouping of people who are an advancing religion is one of the recognised charitable purposes. You set up a loose grouping of people and you're advancing religion, charitable purpose, public benefit, nobody's making a profit out of it. There's a whole load of ramifications of what public benefit means, but that's essentially that. Then you just are a charity, okay? I was meeting with a church leader the other day, and he was amazed at that thought, that you can't avoid being a charity once you set up a church, okay? That's the first thing. Charitable purposes, as I said, include advancement of religion, public benefit. Now, you have to be able to demonstrate public benefit. I'm sure you all know when you're sending in your returns, if you're registered with the Charity Commission, you have to be able to describe the ways in which what you're doing is for the benefit of the public. But actually, that's a fairly low bar to get over because the courts don't want to go there with assessing what religion is for the public benefit or not. So there's a whole load of legal case law about that. And essentially, if you are open to the public and if the public can see ways in which you are making the message of the gospel freely available to them, and there are ways in which it is having an impact on people's lives. Everything we've been talking about, the good works that flow out of the gospel are part of what it means to demonstrate public benefit. Okay, so that's just where you are in terms of charitable status. So because of that kind of twofold definition, the purposes test is really crucial. In churches, we don't really talk about it much. You know, it's not kind of top of our agenda. But purposes in charity law are really crucial to everything that you do. Your charitable purposes, as they are set out in your constitution, are the absolute parameters for what you can do as a church. Okay, so it's really important that you get those right and that you're clear about them and that you know what they encompass. Usually, in a church, those purposes are something like for the advancement of the Christian faith in accordance with a doctrinal basis. Now, there's a big question mark in my mind about how far that extends. There's a piece of guidance from the Charity Commission on Religion and the Public Benefit that talks about all the possible things that Christian organisations might do as part of the outworking of Christian love. And, you know, I've kind of run thought experiments with myself. Does it mean a church could give a grant to the RNLI? Or do you know what I mean? How far could that go? The only help we've got in that piece of guidance is that it says there must be some connection that is evident to the outside world of what the link is between your Christian faith and what it is you are doing. Okay, so you need to think really carefully about is what we are doing encompassed by the ways in which we are demonstrating our Christian faith? I think this becomes particularly important if a church is thinking of setting up new activities or a new area of work. So let's suppose you're thinking about teaching English as a foreign language or opening a church cafe. Somebody asked me about that earlier. A whole load of other things that you might do. There are basically two ways of doing them, aren't there? One is to say, we're going to make this part of the church's activity. We're going to keep the link with the gospel really tight. We're going to make sure, I was talking to somebody yesterday who said, when we're teaching English, actually, we say to people as we start the classes, we're from the church, we want to do this as an expression of Christian love for you. Not necessarily assuming that you're going to respond to the Christian message, but that's why we're doing it. And I think that helps keep the link really closely between your advancement of Christian faith and these other activities that you're doing. The other way of doing it is to say, actually, we're going to set up something different. And it won't necessarily be directly connected with what our church purposes are. And at that point, I think you need to wonder about setting up a separate related charity, actually, to do that separate thing. So just worth thinking, as you're expanding into new areas, as you're beginning to do new things, how are we encompassing this within what our statement of purposes is as a church? And I think that piece of guidance is actually really helpful in forcing churches to think, how does this demonstrate the gospel to people? Okay, if you don't mind, so I'm going to come back to questions at the end. Is that right? Thank you. Yeah. There are other ways of dealing with that. One is some churches will add supplemental purposes into their statement, into their statement of purposes in their constitution. So they'll say, we exist for the advancement of God's kingdom, and in addition, we will advance education, or we'll carry out healthcare, or we'll look after the elderly, etc., etc. That's fine, and I think there are probably ways of doing that that tie those things together well, but there's also a risk that actually those things become standalone and part of the church's activities become kind of diverted into achieving one of those other purposes and separated out from advancing God's kingdom. That's just worth thinking about if you're doing new activities. The other thing, just worth remembering, that the public benefit test is against each purpose, and the way in which it is assessed is quite different. So if, for example, you advance education, the Charity Commission will look for very different kinds of things when it is saying, are you doing that in a way that is for the public benefit? Talk to me afterwards if that's a concern for any of you. If you're changing your charitable purposes, you think, actually, you look at your purposes statement, you think, we're just not sure this is fit for purpose anymore. Or if you've got a doctrinal statement that's very closely tied into your statement of purposes, there are times when, if you're changing the wording itself, you will always need charity commission consent. There'll be other constitutional requirements on you. You may need a 75% majority voting threshold, but you will also always need charity commission consent to change your purposes. There are some very limited exceptions, depending on how your constitution was set up originally, but usually you will need that. So just don't go ahead and do that without asking first. And then the other thing to think about in terms of purposes is, for those of you who were around last year and went through the process of the FIC changing its own constitution, you'll remember that there is a link between the purposes of the organisation and the doctrine and the ethos of the organisation. There are particular reasons to do that, and that's to do with the protections that are available under the Equality Act for marriage and gender and sexuality in particular. So the more closely you can tie your doctrinal statements and adopt your doctrinal statements on those issues and link them into your statement of purposes, the better the position will be. Okay, that's everything on purposes. We'll come back to that later if we need to. Secondly, in terms of charitable status and registration, I'm just going to run through, just by way of reminder, when you should be registered. You should always be registered. You, by definition, you are registered if you're a charitable incorporated organisation. So many of you will have gone through that process already. If you're affiliated to the FIEC, you have to register once your income is over 100,000. So again, it's kind of easy to be affiliated to the FIEC, start growing as a church, and suddenly think, oh, actually, we've tipped over the edge. We need to register. Think about that. If you're not affiliated to the FIEC, the income threshold is 5,000. And I dare say there may still be churches out there who feel like they might be exempt and actually aren't. So think about whether you should be registering or not. In terms of compliance obligations and the Charity Commission's inquiries, once your income is over £25,000 a year, you must file with the Charity Commission your trustees report, your accounts and your annual return. If your income is above £10,000 but below £25,000, you only need to send the annual return, okay? But you still need to prepare your trustee's report and accounts. So you need to have one, even if you don't need to file one, because the Charity Commission can ask for them at any time. Now, this is one of those points where this is beginning to feel trivial now. You're sitting there going, why is she telling us about accounts? We came here for creating capacity and change. The reason I'm telling you about that is because the Charity Commission uses accounts filing as a benchmark for, is this charity run well or not? And as soon as a charity has failed to file its accounts, particularly if it's done so more than once, they will investigate and they will find whatever else they can, to be honest. They're not necessarily out to get you, but they will look for whatever else they can to see whether the charity is being run well or not. So filing your account, it's a really easy win, in a sense, but it's potentially massive if you fail to do it. Just worth having a system to be on top of that. Okay, that's everything to do with Charity Commission regulation and charitable status. Let's move on to look at trusteeship. The reason I'm covering this is because I think there's a lot of potential for confusion. My observation is that churches' practices have changed a lot over the past at least 30 years, certainly 50 years, in terms of who the trustees are, what their role is, how people perceive the role of trusteeship in a church, particularly independent churches. So let's just think together about trusteeship. The legal definition of a trustee, I've put it on the handout, is the people who have control and management of the administration of a charity. Okay, it's a functional test. It is the people who, in fact, have control and management of a charity, not necessarily the people who have been appointed to the role of a trustee. So the risk is, we'll come on to spiritual and legal oversight in a minute, but the risk is if, in fact, there are people in the church who are the major decision makers, they will be the trustees, okay? And everything about that we're going to come on to about trusteeship will apply to them. So you just need to think really carefully, does the structure we've got reflect the fact that actually the trustees are ultimately the people who are responsible? Now, my observation is, it's not always been the case that that's how trustees have been treated in independent churches. Sometimes there's been a sense of there's the leadership team here and there's some trustees over here. And I think that's, that split is becoming somewhat untenable. We'll think about how that might work in a minute. So I think that historical split between kind of what you might think of as spiritual responsibility, usually with the pastors and possibly the elders as a group, and legal responsibility with deacons and or external trustees, I think is becoming difficult. I think it's difficult because of the legal definition and because of the increasing expectations on the role of trustees. I mean, there's no doubt that over the past 10 years, in the time I've been practicing charity law, the expectations of what trustees are obliged to do have massively increased. And that's, you know, that's just a new situation to be dealing with. I think there's also a question, to my mind, humbly I may submit, there's a theological question. I mean, if you're deciding to do a church plant, it's unclear to me whether that's a spiritual decision or a legal one or a financial one. It's all of those things, isn't it? So the idea that you can split out decision-making in that way, I think, is difficult. So I also am very well aware that there is no perfect answer to that question. So I think I can say this on the record. I'm from Eden Baptist Church. We have our elders as trustees for precisely these reasons, because actually we recognise that that's the role that elders play in the church. But I'm very mindful that when people are appointed as elders, they may not be thinking, I'm happy to take on the role of trusteeship, or that I've got the gifts and abilities and skills to take on the role of trusteeship. And that's not an easy position to be in. And I think this is one example where the law and the practice of running a church are not easy to make fit together well. And let's just recognise that and say we're doing the best we can with what we've got in terms of how the law works. So in terms of deciding who should act as trustees, obviously we've talked about ultimate oversight. It's worth also thinking about really nitty-gritty things like your quorum for meetings and your voting majorities. So let's suppose you think, you know what, we need people in addition to the elders to be on our trustee body, okay? Would it be fine, it may be, but would it be fine in your church if actually at a meeting two elders turn up, four deacons turn up, and all the deacons vote against whatever the elders have proposed? You know, think about how that's actually going to work in practice when it comes to voting, and, you know, a really kind of nitty-gritty, difficult decision where how people may feel about it actually matters. So that's just worth thinking about. I'm going to run through some of the issues that you need to think about in terms of appointing individuals as trustees. So eligibility and disqualification. Again, I'm not sure churches necessarily think about this when they're appointing people to trusteeship. Some people are not permitted to be trustees without prior Charity Commission consent. And the grounds on which people have been disqualified have recently been extended. So it used to be mainly financial crime. They're now extended to other types of offences, terrorism, bribery, child protection, perjury, etc., etc. In most cases, none of that will matter to you. But it may, actually, in some churches, some charities, you've got a reformed ex-offender, actually, you want to appoint them to the trustee body, it will matter, and you will need to think about that process. The other ground is when you have already been disqualified as a trustee previously by the Charity Commission or the Scottish regulator. So think about eligibility and disqualification. The way to do that easily is to check the Charity Commission register, so that they now have a register of disqualified trustees. Do that before you appoint someone, and then you can say, we checked, and they weren't disqualified. If you need to, apply to the Charity Commission and say, we think there are good grounds for appointing this person, and here's why. And we can help you with that if you need to do that. The other thing to think about is what's called the fit and proper persons test under the Finance Act. Completely unrelated. Annoyingly, charity law is like this. There are all these unrelated bits of law. It's a separate test from charity trustee disqualification. There is no definition of a fit and proper person, which is a shame. It applies to senior management roles as much as it does to trustees. So I think if you had a senior pastor who was not a trustee, you would probably also need to be thinking about this fit and proper persons test. The way in which the test is applied varies slightly depending on the role. So if you've got someone who is appointed as church treasurer, it really matters whether or not there is any financial misconduct in their history. if they're being appointed a senior pastor and they're going to have nothing to do with money, then it may not matter. So just think about that. The easy way, and this is going to sound like such a cop-out, but the easy way to deal with it is to ask for the declarations. And I've put both references on your form. The trustee declaration is one, the fit and proper person's declaration is the other. It's a little bit like going through customs and somebody saying, have you got explosives, isn't it? The answer's no. Similarly, just having the form will mean the charity commission will say, well, at least you asked. And I'm afraid sometimes that's the best you can do. Again, come back to me if you need to ask about that. Lastly, on trustees, who you can appoint as trustees, I'm sure you know this, but you remember that you cannot appoint someone who is employed by or otherwise remunerated by the charity as a trustee unless your constitution expressly permits it or unless the Charity Commission consents. So most churches will want to appoint someone who is employed or remunerated. They will want to appoint their pastor or somebody else. Remember that your constitution needs to cater for that. If you're going to the Charity Commission either to amend your constitution or to get the consent separately, they won't allow a majority of trustees to be in a remunerated role. So, and this happens a lot with church plants when they are setting up independently. If you've got, say, your pastor and your assistant pastor, and you've only got one other elder at the moment because it's a church plant, actually that becomes difficult if they're being remunerated from the church itself. So think about that. There may be ways of making that work slightly differently. Remember, too, that remuneration includes other kinds of benefit, like the provision of accommodation. And it also includes people who are connected to the trustee. So senior pastor, but senior pastor's wife is employed as church administrator, also ends up falling foul of those rules. Just some things to think about there. I'm going to touch very briefly on trustee duties, okay? Only because, again, I think it's something we don't really talk about much in churches. I need to add here that trustee duties is the kind of thing I have often done half day or whole day's worth of training on. So the amount we're going to be able to cover in this little session is very limited. I'm just going to give you some very brief highlights. The first thing is to say that the role of a trustee is both strategic and fiduciary. Okay, and what I mean by that is I think there's a perception that a trustee is someone who is there to say no to things or there to tick boxes or manage the money. Do you know what I mean? This kind of perception that a trustee is, it's a difficult role. And the visionary people are somewhere else. They're not trustees, you know. And that actually that perception can create quite a lot of tension if that's how you appoint people. I think that what's behind that is a misunderstanding of the nature of trusteeship. That a trustee role in a church is to think about the big vision, is to think about the strategy. Your duty as a trustee is to think about how to steward the charity's resources, the church's resources, towards your charitable purposes. So if you've got charitable purposes that are advancing God's kingdom, your legal requirement is to do everything you can to advance God's kingdom. Well, that's great news, isn't it? You know, the law's requiring you to do everything that God has asked you to do in that role. And that is part of what it means to be a trustee. But to do so in a way that is responsible and trustworthy and, so far as you can, above reproach by outsiders. Though, to my mind, those are two aspects of the same thing. They're not different things. So it's no good sitting on a pot of money and having a pristine building but having a minimal effect on people's lives. We all know that that's ridiculous. That's not achieving the purpose at all. Equally, there's no point having a vision for church growth without thinking about what could hinder it if it were to go wrong. Okay? It's also why you need a team of trustees, because you need each other in those kinds of roles. The fiduciary element is about acting with the utmost good faith and solely in the best interests of the church. And the way in which that translates in legal terms is what's called the no-profit rule and the no-conflict rule. So we've talked about not allowing the trustees to receive any benefit. It also means not allowing the trustees to have any conflicts of loyalty. So if you're a trustee, if you're in a church leadership role and a trustee of a church, but you happen to be a trustee of another organisation as well, there will be times when there are conflicts of loyalty there. It can happen in personal relationships as well, actually. There are times when conflicts of loyalty will arise because of the nature of the relationships within the church family. you need to manage those. Even if your constitution permits the trustee benefit or the trustee remuneration, you need to have a process for managing conflicts of interest and loyalty in addition to that. So the person may be fine to be receive accommodation or remuneration, but the rest of the trustees will need to go through a process of thinking, is this actually in the best interest of the charity for this to happen? Again, if that's not in your constitution, think about that and come and see us. I have to say as well, conflicts of interest is usually one of the things that the Charity Commission finds in an investigation. So once you've not filed your accounts, they'll come and look at you and they will find something about conflicts of interest, partly because it's very hard actually to avoid all conflicts of interest, partly because they're difficult to manage well and to be rigorous about. And I would encourage you to be as rigorous as you can, because in terms of the trust of your church members and in terms of the reputation with outsiders, it's one of those things that I think the perception can be very dangerous. And then the last thing on trustees' duties is about prudence and skill and care. So the duty of prudence, one of those slightly odd words in a legal context, it basically means acting towards the church's property as you would in relation to the property of somebody else towards whom you had a moral obligation. And again, I think this is one of the ways in which the law requires you to do what God asks you to do, actually. This is his money and the church members' interests as well, and you are being asked to think about them and not yourselves with it. So that's the duty of prudence. The duty of skill and care, again, just worth thinking about. Do the body of trustees have the kinds of skills and expertise that they need to carry out the role? Think about adding new trustees if you can, and if it's not tied into eldership and that doesn't distort your ecclesiology. Think about inviting contributions from non-trustees, for example, through your diaconate or in some other way. Get professional advice if you think, between us, we just don't have the expertise to deal with this. Remember, too, that if you are someone who has got a professional background or has particular skills in an area, you bring that to the role, okay? So all trustees are expected to act reasonably and carefully, but if you have expertise, you can't sit there in the meeting pretending you don't know about that thing, okay? So you bring that to the role with you, and the standard for you is actually a little bit higher on those particular issues. And it is a duty on trustees, I'm not just saying this to plug practical services, it is a duty on trustees to get professional advice where they lack expertise between them. Just before we have a little break for a question for you to think about, I'm going to talk a little bit about what's called good governance. There's been a lot of talk about this in the charity sector more broadly. You will have seen some of the coverage of things like Kids Company and the Olive Cook disaster and all that kind of thing. And everybody talks about good governance. To my mind, it's where all those things about trustees' duties meet the reality of what it's actually like on the ground trying to run a charity. It may feel as if it has little to do with churches. You don't normally do public fundraising. You don't normally do have government grants, that kind of thing. But I think the principles of what's going on in those debates are exactly the same, okay, for every kind of charity. How do the responsibilities on trustees translate into running the church well? What does it look like in practice in this particular church? And the shorthand, to my mind, is organisational effectiveness. How do we organise ourselves well so that the kinds of change and growth that we want to see are achieved, and to minimise the risk of things that would disrupt that from happening? Again, I think when you're thinking about legal duties and good governance, it's not have we ticked all the boxes. It's not are we legally compliant. Those things are important, but it's more how do we achieve the things that we have set out to do under God as well as possible? Okay, that's what good governance is about. There's a particular sector-wide code that has just been produced earlier this year called the Good Governance Code, produced by a number of charity sector umbrella bodies. It is at least specific to charities rather than to corporate organisations. So a lot of the other kind of literature on governance is about corporates. It's relevant to charities, but it still needs quite a lot of translating into churches. So I would recommend you read it, but read it kind of proactively, not thinking, oh, look, this isn't relevant to us, but thinking, how do we make this relevant to us, actually? Because all of those principles will still apply. The Charity Commission is using that code as its benchmark for how charities should be run. And they will, they've said they will take an approach of basically comply or explain. Now, I think there are all sorts of ways in which churches can sometimes explain why they're not complying. So to take a really easy example, one of the sections in the code is on diversity. If you are an FIEC church and you signed up to your Women in Ministry statement and your elders are your trustees, you will only have male trustees. And to that extent, you will not be compliant with the code. That's fine. It's a theological issue and you've got good reasons for it. But actually going through the process of thinking, here's why we don't comply with this, but actually we can at least think about, is our trustee body diverse in the sense that it can be? Are we serving our church well? Are we serving our community well in terms of the people that we think are appropriate to serve as elders? That's a legitimate question to be asking. Do you see what I mean? So translate the code into your own context. I just want to highlight two particular aspects of good governance that I think are relevant, especially for churches as they're going through a time of change. And the first one is delegation and accountability. So I think even in a small church, church plant or a church that's small in number and where there may be few trustees or pastoral staff, a lot of what the church does is delegated, just by definition. You've got all sorts of people running all sorts of things that go on in the church. And if you're expanding or you're doing new projects, the cracks in your delegation processes will begin to show. That is what will break, if you like, as you do new things. So I think it's well worth thinking about, as you're doing new things, as you're expanding, as you're growing in other ways, what is it you need to review about who is deciding what? Who is delegating to whom? Who is holding who to account, actually, for whether they've done things well or not? How do we need to scale up that whole system of delegation to meet the new challenges that we're facing? So to my mind, I think the lack of clarity around delegation accountability will either mean that nothing gets done, because actually everybody's thinking, nobody's asked me to do it, or we're not quite sure what we should do, or everybody will be trying to do it and you'll all be pulling in different directions. And sometimes it means a senior pastor ends up trying to do everything, and your church's ability to grow or change will be limited to the senior pastor's capacity. So think really carefully about delegation. Think about, some charities have what's called a governance framework or a mind map. There isn't an answer to this, obviously, because it depends on each church, but just have a plan in mind, as it were, for thinking about how delegation will work and how accountability upwards will work as well. And the second area I just wanted to highlight is about good decision-making. And again, I've put the reference to a Charity Commission piece of guidance there. It also needs translating. It's from a secular perspective. But I think it's very helpful about making decisions well in a legal sense. Obviously, in a spiritual sense, there are all sorts of factors that go into making a decision well. But in a legal sense, there are also some things that you need to be bearing in mind. If you're going to embark on any kind of major project, think in advance about not just what is the project we're doing, but what should the decision-making process look like? Who do we need to consult? What advice do we need? Where do the conflicts of interest arise? What information do you lack? That kind of decision-making process. I have to say, when this piece of guidance came out, I read it, or I saw that it had come out, and thought, why on earth do we need guidance on making decisions? Surely it's really obvious. And as you read it, and as I've trained trustee bodies in it, I've become very aware that actually there's some really helpful stuff in here on doing things well and not tripping up over making silly decisions and finding yourselves in breach of your obligations. So I've got a question for you, which I think is in the handout. If your elders are also your trustees, how do they ensure that they comply with their legal obligations while still keeping spiritual growth and transformation their main priority? I'm not going to give you answers, by the way. I just think it's helpful, actually, to think about how that might work for you. Turn to the person next to you and just have 2 or 3 minutes to talk that through. Okay. I'm going to draw you to order, if I may. That's an expression. I'm over the time. We can come back to those conversations later, but let's press on for now. We're going to move on to look at some of the kind of operational things that are going on in church. I have to say, some of these areas are definitely not my specialism, and there are other people in the room who actually know about them. So I'm going to give you really simple bullet points, and then anything complicated, I'm going to refer to them. So the first thing to talk about is staff and volunteers. I've put on the handout, just think about, as trustees, you need to be thinking about your staffing structure as a strategic issue, particularly in terms of growth or change, and to think about building capacity into your staff team. Okay. Now, I know there are all sorts of controversies around what should staff be doing, what do you expect church members to do, etc., etc. I'm not going to touch on any of those. I just think it's very easy for churches to be reactive in thinking, oh, no, we need this. Oh, drat, let's find someone. Rather than thinking, what might we need in 2 or 3 or 5 years' time? And how do we start the process of employing someone to that role if we need them now, so that we've got a bit of headroom and we can start doing things in advance, rather than everyone being completely stretched. I was talking to a pastor a week or so ago, not an FIAC church. They were a church plant. They've grown from 20 to 100 people in about 3 years. He's a senior pastor. They've got a part-time church administrator. They're thinking about their next recruitment, and his automatic assumption initially was, well, in that case, we need an assistant pastor. That's the automatic next step. And he said to me, actually, what I think we need is an operations manager. We need someone to help us build everything else that the church needs so that we can then appoint our assistant pastor and we know we've sorted things about funding and buildings and everything else. I was really intrigued by that. It wouldn't be every church's answer, but I think it's well worth thinking, not just how do we grow an enormous vine, in other words, how do we add capacity into our disciple making and evangelism all the time, but how do we grow the trellis alongside it in our staffing structure? Again, think about the line management and delegation processes that go alongside that. As the church staff team grows, you don't want your capacity to be limited to your senior pastor's ability to oversee all those people. So you will also need to be thinking, can we flatten out the structure somehow to take the pressure off the senior pastor, but make sure it all works relationally and functionally. Think about the role that your lay elders or the others, voluntary trustees, can play in that. In terms of your employment arrangements, it's just worth getting the basics right. Employment claims are very sad and difficult and painful. Emotionally, spiritually, sometimes very damaging as well. So make sure you've got your employment contracts in place, make sure you've got your statement of particulars and your job descriptions. Think about job descriptions every now and again, just update them as and when things change in the church. Nick, and there's a handout as well on staff handbooks and policies and all that kind of stuff. Just worth getting it right. Think very clearly as well about the roles for which there is a genuine requirement that the person is a Christian, firstly, and that they're a member of the church, secondly. They may not actually be the same things. They may be. But you need to think about that for each role. Okay, so don't just assume that because you're employing someone in a church, they must be a Christian. You need to be able to justify that on each occasion. To my mind, all of this kind of stuff is about transparency and love, being really clear with people so that you are loving towards them in what your expectations of them are. Similarly, with the distinction between employees and office holders, I know many of you will be familiar with that distinction. There's been a whole load of case law on it over the past kind of 8 years or so. You need to be really clear about whether or not someone is an office holder appointed under the Constitution and entitled to whatever the Constitution grants them, and or an employee under a contract with the church. That has huge implications for them personally. It has can have huge implications for the church as well. Again, I was dealing with a situation a few months ago where a senior pastor's pension rights were at stake, and that was precisely the question. And that can be, again, really difficult and painful and is well worth getting right. And it's a very confusing area of law as well, and often turns on the particular scenario you have in place. In terms of voluntary roles, just some pitfalls to avoid. Much of what goes on in a church is done by volunteers, isn't it? It's crucial to the functioning of the church. Remember that volunteers can't be paid other than their actual direct expenses being reimbursed. If they are paid, and I'll come on to what payment might mean in a minute, but if they are paid, it's likely that they will end up having some kind of employment status. And at that point, there's all sorts of questions about things like the national minimum wage and what their rights are, et cetera, et cetera. There have been recent cases precisely on the minimum wage point. Payment would include something like giving them rent-free accommodation or giving them a living stipend somehow. So I've been asked the question directly, surely we can give them money for food and accommodation for the week? Well, no, because actually that's pretty much like a salary. So just think very carefully about that. Think too about role descriptions for volunteers. I think it can be really helpful, actually, particularly for a role that's a key one in the church, to have a description of what that role should look like and how it fits in your whole staffing structure and your pastoral structure. But be very careful about the level of expectation that you put in that role description, because as soon as it begins to look like a contract, again, that may be a bit difficult, but still worth having. Again, think carefully about that. That's what I'm going to say about staff and volunteers. I'm really sorry. I'm sure there are lots of other questions about that. Let's move on to buildings and what you might be doing with your buildings. Again, as churches change, the question of what they do with their premises often becomes key. The starting point is just to be really clear about the ownership structure. Do you actually own your building at all? Do you have a lease? Is it held on trust for you by somebody else? Find that out first before you start doing anything, in particular building anything or knocking anything down. For most churches, there will be, unless you're a CIO, there will be some kind of trust arrangement in place. And at that point, you need to think really carefully about whether the building trust purposes fit alongside your charitable purposes or not. So the degree to which there is overlap or not in those things can make things easier or harder to navigate if you're doing anything new. Just take a really easy example. Some of the older trust documents will have closed communion as a requirement in their property trusts. Obviously, the church may then have moved on since and will not have closed communion in its constitutional requirements. And at that point, there's a big question mark around, well, hang on a minute, are we still allowed to meet in this building? And what do we need to do to make that work if you're doing anything differently in the building? I've put about condition. building maintenance issues are the bane of every church trustee body and the last thing that anybody really wants to think about. But again, to my mind, those things become overwhelming over time unless they're managed in advance. So I think it's part of the responsibility of the trustees. Again, you may not feel like it's part of the responsibility of the spiritual oversight, but certainly part of the responsibility of the trustees to plan in advance, how do we stop this becoming a problem in 10 years' time? How do we maintain the building or have some systems in place for maintaining the building that stops it becoming overwhelming? And particularly if you're going to do anything different, you know, think about what your future uses might be. Might you want to change use in 5 years' time? Might you want to set up a church cafe that opens during the week? Think about what that will mean in terms of planning requirements and in terms of structural change as well. I have to say as well, if numerical growth is what happens in your church under God and by his grace, then there will just be increased wear and tear. You need to plan for that as well. Last thing on buildings is occupancy agreements. If any trustee or member of staff occupies it, part of the premises, part of the church's buildings as part of their role, make sure your underlying legal agreements reflect the interconnection between their role in the church and the provision of accommodation. That's potentially a huge tax liability for them personally if you get it wrong. It's potentially also a breach of trust for the church to get it wrong. So again, it's one of those really easy, trivial things that, if it's not done well, can be disastrous. Let's move on to think about some constitutional issues. There are parts of this that I'm going to skip. But let's firstly just remind ourselves of what the constitutional issues are. Your underlying constitutional framework is crucial. So, again, people sometimes feel about their constitution as if once it's done, it goes in the drawer and we can forget about it. I'm sorry, as a lawyer, I can't sympathise with that at all, but I can see how, actually, for a lot of you, it may just be we don't want to have to think about constitution. Your constitution, in legal terms, is the framework for everything you do. It is what the trustees are obliged to comply with as a matter of law. So as soon as you need to begin to depart from it, then it's an indication that you need to change it. You will be assessed against it if something goes wrong. Okay, so as soon as the Charity Commission investigate, or some other bodies on some occasions, they will look at your constitution and say, well, did you do what it said? So you need to know what's in it. And it needs to be fit for purpose for your own sakes to be able to have the capacity to do what you need to do in the future. Think about your church's legal structure. Many of you will have heard about charitable incorporated organisations from practical services before now. I know many of you have already gone through that process. Unless you plan for the alternative, you will be treated as an unincorporated association. I'm going to skim very briefly over this next section because I'm mindful that a lot of you will have heard about this before. But just by way of very brief reminder, if you are an unincorporated association, you exist just as a group of individuals who gather together to advance the gospel. You're not treated as a separate legal entity. The trustees and sometimes also the members are on the hook for whatever that organisation does. Okay, so if it runs out of money or if there's a claim against it, it sits with them. And it makes things difficult and complicated as well in terms of entering into contracts. Just by way of example, if you start employing people, it is the individual trustees who are their employer. If you own a building, depending on how your property trust is set up, it may be the individuals who own the building and you have to transfer it between them individually, etc., etc. There's a whole load of reasons why that structure isn't an easy one to operate well. Think about incorporation. Think about becoming a CIO. That's what I'm going to say about that. We've got a handout on it if you're thinking, hang on a minute, I haven't heard anything about this. So come and ask us about that. The second thing on constitutional issues to think about is membership. So particularly if you do go through the process of incorporation, but I'm mindful that as churches grow from a church, a small church plant to a bigger organisation as well, its leaders will need to think about what the membership structure should look like. There are essentially kind of two choices there. One is to make the members constitutional members, i.e. members who have rights under the constitution. This is partly a theological question. Some of you will answer that differently depending on your theology. The alternative is to have your membership sitting outside your constitution. You have a group of people who are affiliated with the church, who may belong to it in a sense, but whose status as members is not legally enshrined and is not legally binding. It really begins to matter when you start having to take major decisions about anything. So particularly changing your constitution, but maybe also in terms of what you do with your building or appointing new pastoral staff or appointing new trustees. Are the members the people who should be involved in making that decision or not? And does that decision-making process arise out of the constitution, or have you just agreed separately that actually that's how you're going to operate as a church leadership team? Okay, so think very clearly about what membership should look like for you and in your church. Just to flag up as well, there was a case earlier this year on the obligations of members in a charity. It was a slightly odd case, and it was the facts of it were very particular, but it set the case law such that members of a charity are obliged to act in the charity's best interests. The Charity Commission had always said that was the case, and we always kind of assumed that they were right. We now have a case that says it. I'm still working through the implications of what that might mean. I think for churches, there are some interesting questions about what the implications of that are. But essentially, the members of the church, if they are constitutional members, will begin to owe duties to the church. Again, I'm not sure that's actually unhelpful, but they probably need to know it, and we probably need to start ourselves as practical services team thinking about it in those terms. Constitutional review and change. You will need to review your constitution. It's a bit like reviewing your will, if you've got one. You just need to look at it every 5 years and make sure it's still up to date. There will be processes for changing your constitution. Remember that there are particular areas where you will need the Charity Commission's consent to change your constitution. But I think it's well worth reviewing and discussing, does this still do what we need it to for our situation now? The last thing I want to touch on just before we stop for questions is on risk management and insurance. Again, one of those areas that seems trivial and tedious, but one of them I think that the Charity Commission is increasingly alert to. So for those of you who are registered charity, you will know that when you submit your annual return, you have to say, do we have a risk management policy? It isn't a legal requirement that you do have a risk management policy yet, but I feel like the Charity Commission is essentially saying to you as trustees, have you taken your responsibilities seriously? Have you thought about how you're going to manage risk? So you don't necessarily need a formal policy, but I find it hard to see how you're going to answer that question without something, at least. So have a think about what that looks like. Again, it's one of those areas where people feel like it's about risk assessments. We just need risk assessments. It's not. It's about anticipating what might go wrong. And let's put it bluntly, what might hinder the gospel in your church? What is going to bring the gospel into disrepute with your local community? What is going to make it difficult for you to meet in your building, etc., etc.? Those things are worth thinking about and trying to anticipate as far as you can and trying to mitigate against. I just saw yesterday Stewardship have got a blog post on risk management, and they've got I haven't looked at it yet, but they've got a template system for managing, a methodology for managing risk. So that would be worth looking at as well if you're starting from scratch. If everything goes wrong in a legal sense or a kind of operational sense, then you will have recourse to your insurers. And it's well worth thinking about, does that give you the safety net that you need, at least in kind of financial and legal terms? Make sure that it's sufficient, particularly if your activities have changed over time. Don't just renew it. Think about whether it covers what you need it to. It's worth, unless your constitution expressly prohibits it, it's worth including what's called directors and officers insurance. So your trustees' obligations will then be covered by your insurance, unless they act fraudulently or willfully in default. It means if the trustees get something wrong, they've got some peace of mind, at least about being covered by insurance. Think about whether you need professional indemnity insurance. The answer to that depends a little bit on what it is you're doing as a church and sometimes what your broker tells you as well. But for churches that are doing any serious level of counselling work and where they may be exposed to, for example, claims that counselling was unhelpful or potentially even abusive, then there are some levels of insurance that will at least help. Obviously, it doesn't cover everything, but it would cover a claim that the counselling was negligent in some way. So think about whether that should be included. Think about covering your home workers. Obviously, churches often have people who work from home. Make sure insurance covers them as well in their home situations, unless they've got their own cover. I'm going to stop there. I'm mindful of the time. We've got 10 minutes or so. I think let's take questions rather than do this last question. I think you do need to think about that last question. I think we all need to think about it. What are the barriers to doing those kind of things well? But I think we may more usefully spend the time having some feedback and questions, if that's right. I've got a mic. I think it's on. Great, yeah.
I'm trying to think of a generic question, but it's a real situation that's happened in the last month. We're a CIO. We've recently done our constitution. We've got a purpose statement. We've got a vision statement. We know what the purposes of the church are. Recently, we've started renting the church out for an hour on a Monday evening for Slimming World. We don't believe it's in contravention to the gospel, yeah. But I don't believe it is specifically mentioned in our constitution or our CIO that we are now using the building for Slimming World, which I struggle to find a direct link between the furtherance of the gospel and Slimming World.
Yeah.
Have I got a problem?
You may have.
Yeah. Thank you.
I'm going to hand on to some colleagues in a minute, but I think my instinct is, unless you're using your building in a way that you can draw a connection between advancing the gospel and what it is you're doing, there are a number of issues there. One is, are you actually using your resources for the charity's purposes? The other is, there becomes a point, you're nowhere near this at this point, but there would come a point at which there are tax questions around how you do that. Because if you're doing what's called non-charitable trading, which is renting out a building, and you're receiving income from it, eventually that becomes taxable income in the charity. So at the scale you're at, that's unlikely to be an issue. But as soon as you begin to expand that out, that becomes more problematic. I sympathise with you. I go back to my RNLI question. I think there are all sorts of ways in which you might be able to justify Slimming World meeting in a church's building as part of the demonstration of the gospel. There comes a point at which it's a bit tenuous, and I think at which you would have difficulty saying to the Charity Commission, no, we're doing this as part of the church's activities. Fasting, maybe.
That's the issue, that he's taking money for it. For example, if you were just offering it to Slimming World, would there be an issue?
So that's a really good point. I'll repeat the question for the recording. Is it just because you're taking money for it?
Yeah.
In terms of your charitable purposes, no, it isn't. That's to do with how you're using your charity's resources. So you're still potentially on the edge of acting outside the scope of your constitution, whether or not you take money. The tax issue only arises because you're taking money.
Yeah.
So in that sense, they're linked. Does anybody else want to comment on that scenario? I've just launched in there. Anybody else some practical services?
You know, with that particular case, if you have a couple of people from the church attending it, so in that particular case, if you've got a couple of people from the church attending it, would that make it as an evangelistic in the sense of furthering the purposes using it? Like you'd use a toddler group.
I think there would be ways of running a group like that evangelistically,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think the difficulty is, I mean, let's take two different examples. One is the church decides to run its own health and well-being class, yes. And you say up front, we think it's part of living well and using our bodies for God's glory that we eat and exercise, et cetera, et cetera. You could do that. I think the difficulty is, if it's Slimming World, it's a separate organisation anyway. You've invited them to come in on their agenda and do their thing. That's not necessarily a demonstration of the gospel or evangelism. And actually, the two people who are attending the class could go and attend the class somewhere else and it would be evangelistic.
Yeah.
Paddy, feel free to chip in. Or Gemma.
I think the key to it is actually, what does your trust deed say? So for every individual church, it will be absolutely unique. So commonly, a lot of the trust deeds that I deal with for practical services will say something along the lines of, the building is to be used for the public religious worship of God and for no other purpose. That's very clear. So you could not have a Slimming World class in that case. Public religious worship of God and no other purpose. Some of them, on the other hand, will say something along the lines of public religious worship of God and for such other purposes as the trustees decide from time to time, and it may go on to say, as long as it's not political meetings or stuff like that. That's very different. That then leaves it in the hands of the trustees to say we could have X group but not Y group. Now, the difficulty then comes whenever Slimming World come and say, we'd like to have our meeting here. Yeah, no problem. That's an income for us to put towards our charitable purposes. Although, as Caroline says, what's the tax implications in that? It's when Y Group comes along and says, we'd like to have our LGBTQ meeting here.
Mm.
That's the point where the trustees have to say, how can I accept one group but not the other?
Yeah.
So that's why you have to tread the line very carefully. In some circumstances, the older deeds that I look at where it just says public religious worship of God and that's it are often the safety line. But I do sympathise with we do want to reach out into the communities, and often churches are asking me, well, can I do this? Can we allow this group? The answer is yes, but think carefully, because you could then face the question of, you allowed them, why not us? And that's where
and
it's problematic.
That's really helpful, Paddy, thank you. Because that illustrates precisely the point I was making about the doctrine and ethos statements. Because if you have linked in to your statements as a doctrine and ethos, let's suppose you've connected the FIC's ethos statements into your constitution, you would then have grounds on which to say, A, we think this is within our purposes, but B, there are parameters, actually, for the kinds of group that we're happy to let use the building.
Just in response to that, our constitution does have the second one. It's and other such purposes as deemed by the trustees. So Slimming World got through. Ironically, we have had in the last 2 weeks a request from some organisation that wanted to do mindfulness and psychology counselling for, and we said no, because that does not fit with where we are as a church with the gospel presentation. So we actually bit the bullet, and I signed a letter off to say, no, this is the reason, it doesn't fit with our position on the gospel. Sorry.
Yeah.
Goodbye.
Yeah. And you're just going to need to learn to be... Sorry. You're going to need to be consistent with how you apply those parameters. Yeah. Let's take another question. Yeah.
I'd like the answers to your earlier question. We have six elders and six non-elder trustees. Mm-hmm. I'm a new elder and I got dumped into being chair of trustees, Poison Chalice. And there's, for two or three years, they've been fighting as a complete mismatch where one bunch see themselves as the regulatory police, not trusting the pastors and the elders to make the decisions they make. And one of the biggest tensions I can see is that, so we've had a couple of HR issues that got a little bit upsetting that the pastors dealt with in the last couple of years. When somebody has a legal responsibility and therefore... anything that goes wrong sits on their shoulders, but then they don't feel like they have the decision-making power.
Yeah.
It causes massive tension.
Yeah.
So for me, they've spent 3 years going around in circles trying to decide roles and responsibilities.
Yeah.
So we are going to propose to go to a trustee-only...
Elder-only
trusteeship.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so the answer to that question that you posed is really important to me because it would be part of our... proposition for how we move to that new model. Is that something to speak to you about afterwards?
No, it's fine. Well, let's write around a bit. My instinct is that model is the least worst one in theological and legal terms, putting the two together, but that it has its weaknesses. And one of the weaknesses is precisely this whole issue of how do you bring into the decision-making process the expertise that you need from people who may not be elders. I think I'll give you what it's worth my answer, and then let's see what anybody else may want to say. I think it goes back to this point about delegation and decision-making, and that's why I highlighted those issues. Because if your relationship between your eldership and your diaconate and your staff team is strong enough and robust enough that the diaconate and the staff team together can feed into the eldership... and say, helpfully and supportively and constructively, have you thought about this, or you need to remember this, in a way that minimises the tensions because they're not on the hook for it, but which still gives them the freedom to be the kind of safety net that you may need as elders. I think that's part of the answer, at least.
What I was going to propose is that we kind of move to this one, because it feels like we've got two leadership meetings.
Yeah.
So the elders meet, spend hours talking about a topic with six people, and then they're going to have exactly the same discussions with 11 people, but disagreeing this time.
Yeah.
And then they take it to the members, and so 3 months has gone by and no decision's been taken.
Yeah.
As a businessman, that drives me nuts.
Yeah.
So what I'm proposing is we have this elders-only trustees, but then the treasurer would report in and have a finance team that feeds in, comes to the relevant meetings. An ops manager would feed in. Maybe we've got a lawyer in the church that could be our regulatory expert. So you kind of put one team in the middle and just have lots of dotted lines coming into it. So if you're talking about an HR issue with staffing, then you just get your appointed expert, and they come to the elders meeting
in an advisory capacity,
as an advisor. So basically have one team of elders,
but
with a whole pile of advisors ticking off the various boxes.
Yeah.
Do you think that would be a palatable thing?
To my mind, that sounds like a much better answer.
Yeah. Lots of prayer needed to implement it.
Yeah, then, I can see that's difficult. I thought of something else, but it's gone. I'll come back to it. Anybody else? Yeah, at the back.
It's something you said a minute ago about the people making the decisions will deem to be trustees. So a serious child protection issue, which I can talk about because it's in the press, the police come to me, I go to the police, I get embroiled in this, I can't remember how many people in the church were interviewed, I get summoned to court, Nobody ever raised the question of who are the trustees. We need to speak to the trustees about this. But legally, am I now deemed to be a trustee because I'm taking the lead as the pastor in this? No police ever came to me in interviews and said, who are your trustees? No solicitors ever came. Trustees were never summoned to court.
So, in practice,
is it not working?
I'll give you the charity law answer, and I'm sorry to hear about your pain in that situation. That sounds really hard. The charity law answer to that would be that constitutes a serious incident in the church. The people who are trustees are responsible for managing it and reporting on it to the Charity Commission. They should at least, to some degree, be overseeing how that process is managed. So even if you're not appointed as trustee and not technically one, ultimately in charity law terms, they are responsible for making sure that the risk and fallout of that incident is managed well. You're right, there's a complete mismatch around how things actually work in criminal practice when it's a criminal issue, as opposed to what the Charity Commission will do and how it will treat it. Usually, while there's a criminal investigation going on, the Charity Commission will leave it well alone and then come back to it later once the outcome of the investigation has become known. So that may still be all to come, I'm afraid. Yeah.
It might be a specific question, but do you have any advice for churches that own buildings and how they can protect an asset? We've had some advice about setting up a separate charity that or trust that will just manage the one asset. What would be your advice on that going forward?
There are a lot of variables in how you answer that question. I've done some work with non-FIEC churches, other denominations, where it has made sense to set up a separate charity and to be clear about the independence of that charity from any of the other associated groups. I think it depends very much on what it is you're trying to do with it. The trustees need to think about, can we use this well for the church's purposes, or actually do we need to use it for revenue? Is it an investment for us? There's almost too many variables to be able to give you a helpful answer, I think.
I think the trustees are thinking, how they protect the asset against any litigation that might come.
And can you just tell me why there might be litigation?
Just if a trustee or, say, a pastor makes a significant mistake or an error and there is some lawsuit that's brought against them.
Okay.
You know, the building would be the value that may be...
So because of the Scottish case, yes, I remember now. You're right, there's been some precedent in Scotland. I have to say the charity law in Scotland is quite different, but there's been some precedent in Scotland for setting up a separate property arrangement aside from the church, so that if the church is sued, the property asset is not available. To my mind, this is a bit of an off-the-cuff answer, but to my mind, the reasons why that may have been evident in Scotland don't apply in quite the same way in England, because charity law is assessed differently there. I'm also not... To my mind, it creates more problems than it solves, because there are some circumstances where you could actually go behind that and say, well, this other charity over here is equally responsible for whatever was going on. You've got to create two separate charitable structures and be able to manage them with two sets of trustees and make sure those trustees work well together. There may be reasons to do it, but I'm struggling with assuming it's a good outcome. Yeah. Anybody else? Another question? Yeah.
I've got about six questions here. But...
We've got about 4 minutes.
we're a church plant. We've probably got a constitution on the back of a fag packet somewhere.
Yeah.
That was done quickly to open a bank account.
Yeah.
We hire a youth centre where we meet.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the pastor, but I'm bivocational, so I'm not paid by the plant.
Mm-hmm.
What's my legal status in terms of employment, etc.?
Yeah, it sounds like you need to come and talk to us. it sounds as if, it depends very much on what's on the back of your fact packet, but it sounds as if you would have been appointed as a pastor under the constitution of the church and are probably likely to be an office holder because there's no other kind of relationship between you and the church as an employee, possibly. But my recommendation would be that as the church becomes established, it looks at both its constitution and its employment/officeholder relationships and make sure those things work well together. And again, people will reach different answers. So this whole officeholder question, some people feel very strongly about it on theological grounds, and I can see why. There are particular reasons why you might say, actually, a pastor is not at the beck and call of the church that employs them. They're not. It's technically, in legal terms, it's known as a servant-master relationship. Well, that's not what a pastor is. And some people feel very strongly that for that reason, a pastor should only ever be an office holder. Some other people take the view that actually, because you then lack any employment rights, the pastor, it leaves the pastor very exposed and unprotected.
I've previously been an office holder.
So there are lots of arguments either way. What you are at the moment will depend on the facts on the ground. I think my recommendation would be think about what you need for the next 3 to 5 years.
It's not classed as a volunteer.
It may be.
I'll come and talk to
maybe.
You.
Maybe, yeah. Yeah. Nick's your man. Nick's your man.
Don't worry, we'll visit you.
Nick there I was going to send it in blue hoodie. That doesn't help, does it? This gentleman here, sorry, you've been waiting. I'm sorry.
Very simple one, this one. Filing of accounts under 100,000.
Yeah.
Is that required for registered charities or for all churches?
Filing accounts under 100,000. So if you're not registered, no. But if you are registered, it's over 25. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's right. Yeah, if you're not affiliated to the FIEC, you have to register once your income goes over £5,000. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's a signal to end. Look, somebody upstairs is clapping. Feel free to come and talk to us. I hope that's been helpful and not just giving you more questions. Thank you for coming.